Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
There is nothing sexy and nothing special about getting a tan line. And I always describe trends. It's like fashion. It comes and goes.
Skincare for tweens and teens is almost an obsession. But mostly it's not needed for young, healthy skin. And often it's dangerous. Like the tan lines trend. So we find out what is hot and what is not here on The Wire Weekly. So stay tuned. But first, the Monash IVF clinic has disclosed a second incident in which the wrong embryo was transferred to one of their patients instead of the embryo from the woman's partner. Monash IVF revealed the error on Tuesday morning via a statement made to the Australian Stock Exchange. Maeve Groom has this story.
This latest bungle follows a previous incident back in April where the same company mistakenly implanted the wrong embryo into one of its Brisbane clinic's patients, resulting in the birth of a baby with no genetic link to the woman who sustained the pregnancy. Senior Research Fellow in Global and Women's Health at Monash University, Karen Haberberg, highlights that IVF mistakes such as this can never be completely ruled out due to human error.
The bottom line is that as soon as humans are involved, that there is a potential for something to go wrong. And it's just in this instance, obviously, it has enormous consequences for the people involved. But human error is a factor that you can never really completely eliminate. And I guess you need to look at it at the context of how many, there's about 120,000 IVF cycles in Australia every year. And you know, these are the two known cases. There might be others that we don't know of, I don't think there is a completely 100% foolproof system.
Family creation and surrogacy lawyer Sarah Jefford argues that there is no room for human error in IVF procedures, and clinics need protocols in place to ensure that events like this never happen again.
So I think for Monash IVF, they really need to consider what protocols are in place at each of their clinics to make sure this doesn't happen again. I think patients to IVF clinics really need to be assured that the instances are so rare that they should never happen. We don't really have a lot of space for human error in IVF treatment.
There are also serious ethical and legal implications involved when it comes to cases like Monash IVF for both the birth and genetic parents of the embryo.
If it was the case as the previous, the Queensland case of an embryo being transferred, did not belong to the couple that were meant to be receiving it, we have a presumption in Australia that when somebody delivers a baby, they are the legal parent of that child, and we don't really think about the genetics in that context. In that case, though, the people that have provided the embryo and do have a genetic relationship with that child may seek custody or parenting in the family courts, and then it will be up to the family court to determine who should the child be raised by and who should they spend time with and have contact with. I think the presumption would still be very strongly in favour of the birth parents, but we actually don't have precedence for that in Australia, so we don't really know how a court would manage a situation like that. And what a court would consider is in the child's best interests, given that they were born and raised by one family but had genetic links with another family.
Karen Haberberg echoes this sentiment, stating that the best outcome for the child is the most important thing to consider in difficult legal proceedings.
There could be claims on both sides, I suppose, the woman who gave birth, but also the woman whose embryo it is. We don't really know what they are going to do. And in my mind, I think the best and the most benign outcome for the child would have to be the most important thing. And I hope they can come to some resolution that makes it as good as possible for the child.
Monash IVF has stated it will conduct an internal investigation into the matter while simultaneously extending the scope of the original investigation concerning the Brisbane patient. Despite this, many akin to Sarah and Karen feel that national regulation and oversight is needed for the industry.
Monash is doing their own internal review and hopefully they come up with some ways that they can improve practices at their clinics. However, I do think that perhaps this is when a national regulator might get on board to then consider, well, what was happening at Monash that might be happening in other clinics that we're not even aware of, and that it might be where we start looking at national regulation and auditing for clinics. We have that already, but it's actually run by the industry, and perhaps government needs to have more oversight about fertility treatments to guarantee that these things don't happen again.
At the moment, it's pretty patchwork. We've got different regulation in different states, and the idea that we have a national body rather than different state-based regulation, I think, is very appealing. And I think the Australian government and us taxpayers, we actually pay for about half of the cost of IVF to patients. It's subsidised by the government. So I think there should be some mechanism for the public to know when adverse events happen and what's done to make sure they don't happen again. I think learning from mistakes is probably the most important thing.
Karen Hammerberg, Senior Research Fellow in Global and Women's Health at Monash University, ending that story by Maeve Groom.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
The EU is urging Australia to implement its so-called geographical indication system to safeguard the names of European products. It's identified 170 food names and 236 spirit names that Australia should relinquish, including names like feta and prosecco. Thomas Kutis asked Hazel Moyer, an honorary associate professor in economics of patents from the Australian National University, what the EU push to protect trade names was all about.
Well, I think the EU's approach to protecting the names of regional food specialties is their business in Europe. But what they've been trying to do is export what suits Europe to other places, and it really doesn't suit us. I mean, for example, if we take, say, Parmesan, there's at least 300 dairies in the broad region around Reggiano making Parmesan Reggiano. But in the whole of Australia, there's less than 100 dairies, of which 27 produce Parmesan. So the situation's very difficult. The other reason I don't like it is that Europe has a lot of problems with people making fraudulent use of food names. We don't. People in Australia don't do that.
Why are products like feta and prosecco such continuous points in the EU-Australia trade discussions, do you think?
Feta's interesting, right? The Europeans don't want anyone else to call their feta feta unless it's made in Greece. Even under something called geographical indications policy, but feta is not a geographic name. It's a word that means slice in Greek or Italian. And when the Greeks first proposed registering it, the European Court of Justice threw it out. It was challenged by France, Denmark, Germany, and the UK, because they were all happily making feta. So what happened was the EU changed the rules. And then under the new rules, the Greeks had another go, and it went back to the European Court of Justice, who decided on the basis of the fact that Greek people thought that feta was a Greek name, that it should therefore be reserved for Greek producers throughout the EU. And that, of course, had a very negative effect on feta producers in Germany, Denmark, UK and France. And now they want to do the same to us. The other thing about it is that the European law about geographical names says that if you put on your product feta made in Gippsland, that will mislead consumers. I'm sorry, Australian consumers are smarter than that. Feta made in Gippsland is quite clearly not Greek feta.
If we do accept the EU's demands, how will this affect Australian producers who currently use these product names?
They would have to use different names, right? Remember when they had the whole thing about wine and you couldn't call your champagne champagne anymore? That was back in about 1994. right after the world, about the time the World Trade Organization was set up. But the Europeans offered our wine producers a better deal. They said to wine producers in not only Australia, but all the countries of European immigrants, we'll let you sell more wine in Europe if you stop calling your champagne champagne, and if you stop calling your Burgundy Burgundy and call it Pinot Noir. So it was worth it to our winemakers to come up. And of course, they were allowed to use the names of the grape varieties, like Prosecco, Pinot Noir, etc. There was a little problem with champagne because it's a Pinot Noir grape usually, but not always. So they just called it sparkling wine. But it was very easy to come up with alternative names for non-fortified wines. And there was a benefit to our producers because they got to sell more in Europe. So it was win-win. What's happened with Prosecco is Prosecco has been known as the grape variety. It is the name of a kind of grape.
Dr. Hazel Moyer, an Honorary Associate Professor in Economics of Patents and Geographical Indications and other IP trade treaties at the Australian National University, speaking there with Thomas Kutters. Caveman method, slugging, the tan lines trend, social media skincare trends don't always have care in mind. In recent years, social media has been the home to many trends that may cause skin harm rather than solutions, especially in teens and tweens. Dermatologist Dr. Leona Yip from Skin Partners in Brisbane dissects these trends and explains the impacts of following harmful advice from social media, as well as what you can do to avoid the misinformation trap. Ashley Blumen has the story.
Recently, social media has been the go-to place for skincare advice, resulting in many different and sometimes harmful trends. Have you ever heard of the tan line trend or the caveman trend? Here to explain a bit more on the harmful effects of these skincare fads is dermatologist Dr. Leona Yip.
So the most worrying trend that has been going on in social media in the recent few months or 12 months really is the tan line trend, because that is the one that can cause harm potentially, and high risk of that increases risk of skin cancers and sun damage. There is nothing sexy and nothing special about getting a tan line. And I always describe trends, it's like fashion. It comes and goes, but it's not like style where it's timeless and it stays. And what is timeless is good, healthy skin. And this is something that many teens and tweens don't tend to see just yet because they feel it's not relevant for them. So that trend is something that we really need to bust because it is not healthy and it can cause harm. The other trends that we're seeing with skincare and with routines, these are not necessarily harmful, but they're just not something that may keep the skin healthy. They may not be something that looks after your skin barrier, and they may be something that can potentially affect your skin hygiene, such as the caveman trend, for example, which is not washing your skin for days and letting it heal naturally, letting your skin go without cleansing, without moisturizer. And that is not something healthy, because if you're not washing your skin, what's going to happen is you get skin debris, skin cells. These are dead skin proteins that stay on top of your skin, and you get keratin retention, where it looks yellow and your skin can start to smell. You can also get buildup of grease, dirt, pollution on your skin that can contribute to effects on your skin barrier and can cause microinflammation of your skin that can worsen conditions such as eczema as well as pro-aging.
Beef tallow is currently the most recent trend taking social media by storm, but dermatologists are not such big fans.
So beef tallow trend, there's also something that has been very popular because it's touted as being natural. But firstly, what's natural is not necessarily good or beneficial or safe for your skin. So beef tallow may have some moisturizing properties. If you're using something for moisturizing, it's much better to use a manufactured product, so we know what's in the listed ingredients and what it claims to do will actually live up to what it says it would in terms of the listed ingredients. But yeah, I think the problem is we don't know where it comes from, and it's usually these natural skincare companies that do it in small batches. So we don't know what breed of cows it's come from and where it's manufactured and whether it's not or not it's gone through safety testing, for example, and it's not TGA approved. So the safety is questionable. The efficacy is also questionable. And because it's so greasy, there's high risk of causing breakouts, particularly in those with greasy skin and acne-prone skin.
There have also been some positive trends to come out of social media, including skin cycling, using sun protection, and the glass skin trend. Dr. Leonie Yip's message is clear and says that the key is educating people on how to use these products properly.
So my message is that when you see a trend on TikTok, on Instagram, it's really important to find out the credibility and the qualification of the person behind the trend and what they're saying to you. Because on social media, it is not regulated. Anyone can go out there and say something and pick something out from the air and make it sound credible. But it has to be safe, which a lot of it is not. It has to be able to prove that it's beneficial for your skin. There's a difference between scientific credibility and marketing claims. And before you know it, you may be piling on skin problems on top of healthy skin that you may have to seek help for when previously your skin's actually really well.
In light of these concerning skincare trends, dermatologists have taken to social media themselves to combat misinformation on the front lines.
How we practice medicine 20, 30 years ago is very different to how we practice today. Because with the advent of people Googling information and with AI and with social media especially, if we're not out there as figures of medical authority giving credible advice with scientific evidence or with real world experience of what we do and busting myths, I think it gets to a point where we see people with fixing problems that people are getting through trends they see on social media. So it's very important, I think, that as doctors, we are sparing some of our time with preventative medicines and advocacy and education via social media. While traditional media platforms like TV and radio play a really important role, but I think research shows that many young people are scrolling through reels every day and spending hours on their phone. So it's really important that we get onto the social media platform and spread the message that way as well.
Ultimately, if you do decide to take TikTok skincare advice, Dr. Leona's advice is simple.
If you're not sure about what to use, because the world of skincare trends on social media is really confusing. And as a layperson, if you're not used to skin health and what to look out for, my suggestion is always go to a skincare professional and start there. Because we first need to look at your skin and do a skin assessment about what skin type you have, what your concerns are, how old you are there any existing problems, to tailor our advice to what you need to address.
Dr. Leonie Yip, dermatologist, speaking there with Ashley Blumern. Great to hear you're listening to The Wire Weekly in 6CRA in Albany on the great southern coast of WA, in Armidale in New England on both 2UNE and 2ARM, and 4DDD in Dalby in the beautiful Queensland Western Downs. Thanks for being with us. New amendments to Australia's family law came into effect this week, seeing changes in how separation disputes are resolved. These include increased support for victims of domestic violence in property settlements. The Attorney General's department says reforms will make Australia's family law system simpler, safer, and fairer for all families. Meanwhile, other changes are set to impact how pets, property, and finance are mediated between former partners. The Family Law Amendment Bill introduces a new framework to govern pet ownership, with legislation now recognising pets as companion animals instead of property. But there are limitations to how the court can intervene. Jordan Zarella asked Kylie Burke, Director of Burke Mangan Lawyers, to explain why the new laws were needed.
The new laws are aimed to simplify the family law system for vulnerable parties and make the system safer and more accessible. So what's happened is we've been provided with a lot more clarification in the new amendments as to what the court considers in coming to its determination on various issues.
So how will the new reforms ensure that the economic impact of family violence is adequately considered by the courts when dividing property and finances?
The new amendments really do focus on the result or the impact that family violence has had on parties to a relationship. When we look at dividing property between couples, we assess various contributions that have been made throughout the relationship, including financial and non-financial contributions. And what can happen is if there's family violence that's being perpetrated throughout the course of the relationship, then the victim can be impeded in their ability to contribute. And so if they haven't contributed because of the family violence or their capacity has been inhibited, that's now expressly recognised. And it's also recognised not only looking at their contributions throughout the relationship, but also going forward. So for example, if a victim's employment capacity has been significantly impacted due to suffering family violence, and they don't have the capacity to obtain employment or a level of employment whereby they can support themselves and their children, then the court will take that into account when determining whether they should receive more of a property pool than they ordinarily would have, and also whether they should be in receipt of spousal maintenance.
How do you think these reforms might change the outcomes for separating couples, particularly those involving pets?
The focus is going to be on ensuring that parties have an adequate standard of living and that they have a continuous standard of living. When people flee domestic violent relationships, particularly women and children, their financial circumstances are significantly impacted negatively, and that can go on for years. So these new amendments really ensure that situation can no longer occur and that their financial security is provided for to the best extent that it can be within the context of any particular case. In relation to pets, the new amendments have provided some really clear guidelines as to what factors the court will take into account when making orders as to who gets to keep the pet. And this is really good because it enables parties to take this into consideration prior to commencing litigation, and it enables more fruitful discussions so that cases can settle earlier because the guidelines are clearer than what we used to have. But also, family violence is taken into account when determining who gets to keep the pet. And it's not only family violence that's perpetrated against a party or a child of the relationship. It also takes into account any cruelty that's been directed towards the family pet.
Just lastly, you mentioned in your statement that this is the most significant overhaul of family law we've seen in over a decade. Why do you think this is?
Well, the last reforms that we had in relation to financial matters in family law occurred in 2009. So it's well over a decade. And the new amendments really focus on providing what society expects now. So it's really updating the legislation based on what the various inquiries that gave rise to these amendments have reported back that people want. So it reflects what society wants and needs in this day and age.
Kylie Burke, Director of Burke Mangan Lawyers, speaking there with Jordan Zarella.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
There was a search on for an entangled humpback whale last spotted off the coast of Sydney in New South Wales. The humpback whale, who had moved down the coast from Newcastle, was caught in a drumline, which are most notably used around swimming spots to divert sharks as well as used for fishing. Obstacles such as this hinders a whale's ability to seamlessly migrate to warmer waters at this time of year. This humpback whale was also going in the wrong direction. James Bale asked Dr. Raphael Mayod, a researcher from the Southern Ocean Persistent Organic Pollutants Program at Griffith University, how incidents such as these came about and what could be the long-term implications.
But it is likely greater than what we actually know, because not all entanglements are observed and reported.
Where are these coming from? Is this intentional?
The entanglements wouldn't be intentional. They usually come from ghost nets, any sorts of gill nets or discarded ropes and lines from the fishing industry. It could also be from crab pots and shark nets. So any sort of netting that occurs in the ocean can get entangled.
So in your research, you say that during the migration process for many of the humpback whales, they are at their lowest energy levels. So how do whales produce energy for themselves in the first place?
So humpback whales feed intensely in Antarctica on krill, so they get super fat and feed on a lot of krill before they start their migration. So they accumulate all those energy reserves from that intensive summer feeding down in the Southern Ocean.
So what would happen if a whale was unable to complete their migration?
If it's dragging netting, for example, it can tire itself out, so it will run out of energy. Otherwise, it can also impact their ability to reproduce. And if the whale is a pregnant female, for example, those effects can actually be passed on to the next generation. So a female in poor body condition will not be able to provide as much for her newborn calf in the Great Barrier Reef. And so the newborn calf will suffer the consequences on its migration back to Antarctica.
So what are the other risks affecting migration?
Other than net entanglements, you've got ship strikes. You know, Australia being an island nation, it relies a lot on the seaborne trade. So there's a lot of commercial shipping around Australia. And with increasing numbers of humpback whales, we're likely going to see an increase in interactions between vessels and whales. And so that can lead to direct impacts such as vessel collisions and also indirect impacts such as, you know, added underwater noise pollution and also disturbance effects on whales themselves.
What can the public and other major organisations do to ensure that migration patterns for these humpback whales remain secure?
In particular to net entanglements is reporting sightings of entangled whales immediately, making sure that you report that to the appropriate authorities. Here in Queensland, it's SeaWorld, so they do a very good job in helping those entangled whales. Also properly disposing of fishing gear. If you come across any sort of rope or line out in the ocean, picking that up and getting it out of the ocean.
Dr. Raphael Mayod, a researcher from the Southern Ocean Persistent Organic Pollutants Program at Griffith University, speaking there with James Bale. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.